It's now time for the Fantasy 411 podcast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Fantasy 411. I'm Fred Zinke. I'm here with Al Melchior of FanRag Sports and FanGraphs and Fantasy Radio. Happy to have Al with me. He's stepping in on an emergency basis for Matthew. And quite frankly, there was so much exciting news since we last recorded on Thursday that we felt like we needed to jam in one more episode of the podcast before the winter meetings really got rolling. So, Al, thank you for joining us at the last minute here. And, welcome to this emergency edition of the 411 podcast.
Oh, well, my pleasure. Yeah, lots to get to, I know. So I guess we'll get to it right away.
Mm-hmm. So the big news, Giancarlo Stanton traded to the Yankees. I think that trumps the Shohei Ohtani to the Angels signing. So let's start with Stanton and the Yankees. This is the biggest trade we've seen in a while. It's an MVP being traded before he plays his next game. Stanton was already considered, I think, by a lot of people to be a first-round pick. Al, let's cut right to the chase, and then maybe we'll expand a little bit from there. But how early do you think you could consider drafting Stanton now that he's on a team with a more favorable home park than the one he's leaving and a better lineup?
Well, before the trade, and again, I think none of us were assuming he would be a Marlin come opening day. But, I still thought he was more maybe later in the first round. But in updating my rankings, I actually could see taking him as early as sixth overall. So, it's definitely a bit of a boost. I think not so much in terms of the power numbers, because I think that he's sort of impervious to the park factor. But he's going to just have so many run-producing opportunities there with the Yankees that I think it does, for me, actually push him a little bit ahead of Joey Votto, Mookie Betts, Chris Bryant, some players that I probably would have taken ahead of Stanton before.
Okay, now let's come. Now you have him sixth. I said that I felt he could be at least considered as early as third. I didn't say necessarily drafted as early as third, but since we're pretty early in the offseason still, I said considered as early as third. So am I guessing correctly that you still have, say, Paul Goldschmidt and Nolan Arenado ahead of Stanton?
Yes, and Bryce Harper too. So that's why I couldn't see myself taking him earlier than sixth. But, it's going to be an interesting draft because I think there's a lot of consensus around Trout and Altuve being 1-2, but it really is kind of up for grabs after that. So even though I've got Paul Goldschmidt third and pretty solidly third, I don't feel like there's a lot that separates 3 through about 13 or 14. So I do see Stanton being in the upper portions of that group, but it's really close.
Yeah, I can definitely see, there's some downside with Stanton. So I think we're so excited about the hype with the trade and him coming off that huge season, especially huge finish to the season, that sometimes we forget that going into the season, this was someone who was considered like a boomer bust pick, an injury-prone slugger. There is that downside, I think, that you don't get from Goldschmidt, from Arenado. That being said, if somebody wanted to tell me that they feel like Stanton will hit 50 home runs and drive in 135 runs or 130 runs next season and be better than Arenado, I think that's a pretty solid argument. I think it's the injury risk that pushes him. If somebody doesn't want to take him as high as third or fourth overall, I think it's probably the injury risk. So I'm surprised that you have Harper ahead of him. What makes you differentiate Harper from Stanton? Is it mostly the batting average?
Batting average and age, I just still think that there's room for upside with Harper. I think last season may be the upside for Stanton. And I say because just even with the Marlins, I mean, he put up just such eye-popping run in RBI totals that, I think he'll put up better ones with the Yankees this year than he would have with the Marlins. I'm not even sure that he'll top those numbers that he had from last year, with the Yankees this year, because it was just such an extraordinary year for him. So I just think that Harper's got a little bit more upside. And, they both have an injury history. I think Harper's is actually a little more worrisome. But, I'm just going for the upside there with Bryce Harper. And I would just add, too, that I'm also keeping an eye on where J.D. Martinez goes, because I actually think he could be better than Stanton. But I also know that the perception is that he shouldn't be drafted as high as Stanton. So I probably would take my chances and wait till the second round to get Martinez. But I actually think Martinez could be more productive than Stanton, depending on where he lands.
Yeah, it's definitely a possibility. So now moving just slightly off Stanton to some of the other Yankees. So I believe you and I talked earlier in the offseason. I think I was a little more bullish on Aaron Judge than you were. He's definitely still risky, but does the addition of Stanton just making that lineup even better, wearing down pitchers even more, does it make you at all more willing to consider Aaron Judge in round one or at least move him up your ranking?
I think he goes up my ranking slightly, but I don't see him cracking, say, the top 12 yet. So if we're talking about a 12-team league, mm-hmm. I can't see taking Aaron Judge with my number one pick. And first of all, there's just the idea of building a team around Judge when we still don't know how pitchers may adjust, how he may adjust, in his second full season. So there's that element to it. But also just in terms of there being a numbers game, and I mentioned the top six, I would consider plus J.D. Martinez, and then you throw in Joey Votto, Betts, Bryant, Manny Machado, Charlie Blackmon, Trey Turner, Carlos Correa. Those are all players I'd take ahead of Judge, and that list gets me into the second round.
Yeah, it definitely would. I think I would consider him before some of those players. Just I know the floor for Judge is much lower. But I think maybe the ceiling for him is higher. I think he kind of showed that, I guess, last year. Like even if his batting average dips a bit, if he can hit 50 home runs and be, into the triple digits in runs and RBIs, I think some of it for me a little bit too will be exactly how the Yankees put their batting order together. If it's Stanton two, is Judge third? Is he fourth? Like just how they set all that up. I think I would be, but I wouldn't want to get too carried away with it, but maybe a little more bullish on him if he was really sandwiched inside, like insulated around some of the good hitters in that lineup. And another one of the good hitters is Gary Sanchez. Now, was Gary Sanchez already your number one catcher? And does this further distance him from the pack or did you move him at all?
I will be moving him up. He was my number one catcher already and by a good distance over Buster Posey. So, in terms of draft day, it doesn't make a really big difference for me. He was number one by a big distance. He continues to be. I do think it helps his value. So I think like Judge, it'll move him up a bit. But, frankly, I'm not anticipating that I'll draft a lot of Gary Sanchez this year because I think I'd have a really hard time pulling the trigger to take him in the second round. And I'm guessing that's where he's going to go in most leagues. So I certainly think he's, worthy of it just in terms of the value he's going to produce relative to the rest of the catcher field. But again, it's, thinking about, okay, who am I building my team around? Do I want to invest that much in Gary Sanchez? Do I want to invest that much in any catcher? And I'm going to be reluctant to.
Yeah, I agree with you about the second round point. I think that's kind of where Buster Posey would go during his prime years when he had really had distanced himself a bit from the other catchers. And in two catcher leagues, I could see Sanchez maybe in a three catcher league, in a one catcher league falling to the third round. But you're right. It's such a premium draft pick that it impacts your decisions around your staff ace. If you want to try to get an elite base dealer, if you want to try to get, Sanchez is a really good power hitter, but do you want to try to get one of those truly elite power hitters at a different, position? So you're right that there's two sides to it. There's where should Sanchez be drafted, and then are you willing to draft him there? As far as the rest of the Yankees go, do you see any other winners in this deal? Like, does this make you shuffle Brett Gardner at all, or does it make you shuffle any other starting pitchers in terms of now they look to be about as well supported as any group of starters in baseball with the bullpen support and the lineup that backs them?
I would probably not, because at the point in the draft where I'm looking at Brett Gardner, I just don't think it's going to be that much of a game changer. I get your point about run support for the starters, but I've always been a little reluctant to put too much stock in pitcher wins, just because there's a certain degree of flukiness to it. There's also, the question now, too, of how deep starters will go. So I just think that whatever marginal value is added by having Stanton in the lineup, it's not really going to move the needle on any other players on the Yankees roster.
Interesting. I thought maybe Gardner gets at least a little bit of a boost just by if Stanton, especially if Stanton's hitting second. So, for example, last season Gardner reached base. His on-base percentage was 350. He scored 96 runs, whereas D. Gordon, now I guess D. Gordon, he played a little bit more, not that much more actually for how durable Gordon is. His on-base percentage was 341 and he scored 114 times. So that was the only angle I was wondering is if you thought maybe Gardner scores a few more runs if he has Stanton hitting behind him. I get that that's maybe a little too nitpicky. Maybe it just makes... And maybe it makes me feel at least just a little safer projecting Gardner, if he's their leadoff hitter again, to score 90 runs.
Yeah, you know, and I will confess here to not having completed my projections. So maybe once I get a better sense of how he stacks up category by category against other outfielders, I'll be surprised and say, oh, he really ranks higher than I expect. But, yeah, you know, right now just looking at where I picture him stacking up, I just am not feeling it moving him up significantly from where he is.
Yeah, that makes some sense. I mean, and he is also someone who last year, career high in home runs, you know, can he do that again? His batting average has been pretty flat. So, yeah, I understand that. Now let's move south to Miami and talk about all the understated sides of the trade. So, because they do still matter in fantasy. First of all, Starlin Castro, how does this affect his value? Because he could have more of a premium lineup position, but in a worse lineup next year. He's going to the NL, which seems to be losing a lot of star players right now, so that maybe that makes him a factor in NL-only leagues. But in mixed leagues, what do you think of Castro? Is he someone that you want to draft, or is he someone that maybe should start the year on waivers in the 10- and 12-team leagues?
Yeah, the option B, you know, maybe stream him off of waivers. I mean, I don't know what lineup he's going to be in because I have a strong feeling, you know, backed up by a lot of reports that have been out there that the Marlins are going to look to flip Castro. But I think the Marlins in some ways could be a worst case scenario between the ballpark and depending on how stripped down that lineup is going to be. And I would expect it could be very stripped down. But I just think leaving the Yankees and leaving Yankee Stadium and leaving the AL East, in no way can be good for Starlin Castro. I mean, in the 2 years as a Yankee, he only hit 12 of his 37 home runs away from Yankee Stadium. Last season, he had a spike in his batting average, but he had a 347 BABIP that I don't think he can support going forward. So I just see all sorts of reasons to think that Castro is going to fall pretty far short of where he was last year, and that's going to leave him more for the deeper mixed leagues.
And then you mentioned, you know, where that lineup goes from here. If the lineup does stay at least just the way it is now, as far as the key pieces, so if Marcell Ozuna, if Christian Yelich stay there, how much less appealing are they than they were a week ago? Because they've lost Stanton, which I think hurts them. I'm not sure if losing D. Gordon hurts them that much. I mean, D. Gordon's definitely really valuable in fantasy, but I don't know how much that hurts Ozuna and Stanton. So, like, do you see this as a massive downgrade for them, or maybe just a little bit of a notch down?
As of right now, I'd say just a little bit. I mean, it's as of right now, even without Stanton and Gordon, it's an okay lineup. It's certainly, you know, notably worse, but they were sort of middle of the pack last year, and I think as it's constituted right now, they don't become one of the lesser offenses in the majors. So yeah, if the lineup stays put, they'll be hurt a little bit, but you know, Yelich, I think is he's going to get on base, he's going to get his steals, he'll hit for good average, and the run production may suffer. But I come back to those Braves teams, you know, of just a couple, you know, seasons ago, where you know, people were concerned perennially about Freddie Freeman's run production. And, you know, he managed to get his runs and RBIs in a lineup that didn't have much around him. So I think ultimately skill goes a long way, even in a bad lineup. So I think they'll both be okay. And Yelich in particular. Ozuna, I just have questions about his ability to repeat what he did last year because he's been so inconsistent.
Yeah, I agree. And I didn't even mention Justin Bour. When you do mention all the pieces that are still there, JT Realmuto, like Realmuto, Ozuna, Yelich, Bour, Castro, like right now, if it didn't change at all, yeah, I think it's not a lineup that you're concerned about. You know, losing Stanton hurts. As I said, I don't know from a baseball perspective how much D. Gordon really hurts their ability to drive in and score runs. So, I think you're right. I think you can still mostly evaluate those players at face value based on their skill set and where you think they'll go from there. And so now I'm going to jump way west, and we're going to talk about Shohei Ohtani signing with the Angels. And I don't know if this is bigger or smaller news than Stanton in a baseball perspective. In fantasy, it's a little smaller, but still pretty big because this is a big unknown. We were talking about shifting Yankees a little bit up or Marlins a little bit down. Now we're talking about a new commodity, someone who kind of blows our minds, as a lot of people have discussed as far as how to use them. I'm not going to get into how to use him because we've kind of talked that topic, I think, to death lately. Let's just talk about Ohtani since he's here now and he's on a team. We'll start with the pitcher. You know, how many innings do you think he'll throw this year? How do you think he fits into a mixed league rotation? Is he a number two? Is he a number three? Where do you see him as far as value goes?
Yeah, I do see him as a number two, probably lower end. But as far as the innings are concerned, I think 160 is, I'm pretty comfortable with that as a projection because the Angels said they're going to try to keep him on a once-a-week schedule. They're considering a six-man rotation. So, and he went very deep into games in Japan. I mean, I don't really know how that's going to translate. But I think conservatively, you can figure he's probably going to average more than six innings a start and probably make about 25 starts. So that would, get him in the, probably 160 to 165 range. That's where I think he's going to wind up. And I think there's probably a pretty good comp in terms of how Aaron Nola did last year. Because Nola pitched, a little bit more, 168 innings, but a 3.54 ERA. Granted, that's in the NL. I think Ohtani probably can do better than the 12-11 record. But I think the peripherals could be very similar to Nola's. I think the playing time is going to be sort of similar to what Nola did in 2017. So I don't think that's a bad baseline. And that should be enough to get Ohtani right in around the top 20.
Yeah, I mean, I think fantasy owners will initially hear 160 innings as almost like a cap, like 150, 160 innings, and think, no, this is someone who isn't going to help me a lot, because I think there's a lot of people whose minds are still in the 2011, 12, 13, 14 days of 200-inning pitchers. There weren't very many 200-inning or even 190-inning pitchers last season. So 160 sounds low, but I think as fantasy owners start to look at it more closely, they'll realize there are a lot more pitchers than they realize who are throwing 175 or 180. So 160 compared to 180 isn't the drop-off as opposed to maybe a few years ago when you were hoping your number two would still give you 200 innings. Do you agree with that assessment, that maybe the innings coming down helps Ohtani's fantasy value?
I think it definitely helps his fantasy value, helps him a lot. And, I think probably the place where you're going to feel it is that he may not have any two-start weeks. On the other hand, if he's as good as I would expect that he's going to be, you're also never going to bench him, so you'll probably get every one of those 160, 165 innings on your roster. But, I think that's what's going to separate him out from the pitchers that would be ranked ahead of him, is the lack of two-start weeks.
And I'm kind of throwing this at you off from the side now, but and how do you feel about him as far as risk goes in comparison to, say, James Paxton or Lance McCullers, or those pitchers who we know when they're going well are really good but miss a lot of time due to injury? So Ohtani's probably less of an injury risk than those pitchers. That being said, he's never pitched in the majors, so he's probably more of a performance risk than those players who have already established that they will be effective if they're healthy. And those pitchers maybe have a higher inning ceiling, because although we don't expect Lance McCullers to throw 180 innings, like, it's at least possible, whereas with Ohtani, we think the schedule will make it impossible. How do you feel with him? Do you see him as a risky option, or do you see him as actually relatively safe as long as you keep the ceiling down?
I think those are really good comparisons, especially Paxton. I think his risk level probably is about similar to Paxton, because, like you say, we have a pretty good idea now of what Paxton's going to deliver in terms of per-start performance. But health is a real question mark for him. So I think those things kind of balance out between Ohtani and Paxton. McCullers is interesting. I had a mock draft a few days ago. I got him in the 14th round.
Wow.
And Yeah, and I mean, and I can understand why. And I mean, I didn't, you know, I was among the owners who didn't take him in round 13 or 12 or 11 or, you know, keep on going. But I mean, you know, if he does stay healthy all season long, I mean, I think he's got a top shelf skill set. Mm-hmm. And would be somebody that could go in the top five or six rounds at least in 2019 if he puts together, let's say, 180 innings this year. So clearly the perceived risk with McCullers is very, very high, but I would certainly go Ohtani over McCullers mm-hmm. because of that level of risk. And to be honest, I'd probably take him over Paxton too, because I think that my degree of concern over Paxton's ability to rack up innings and stay healthy is a little bit greater than the uncertainty that I have that Ohtani's not going to be able to translate his stats from Japan to a good degree to the major leagues.
Now let's talk about the hitting side, because that's what really, from a regular baseball perspective, makes it so fascinating. But from a fantasy perspective, is it a big deal? So if you're in, I think in most leagues, you will not be able to use him simultaneously as a hitter and a pitcher, like on the same day, have him able to produce both stats for you. So assuming you have to make that choice, whether it's every day or every week, but you have the choice, do you think fantasy owners are ever going to want to use him as a hitter, or do you think his pitching value is just going to be so much greater and there are so many other hitting options that just it'll be a cool story that, but nobody at the end of the season really says I put him in my hitting lineup more than once all year?
Yeah, and in a weekly lineup league, he's obviously going to have very limited utility. The plan right now, really best case scenario, is that he would DH every other day among the days that he's not pitching. So you figure if he's going pitching once a week, and that leaves the other 6 days, that at most he's going to DH three times a week. So that's just not going to cut it outside of a pretty deep AL only league. I think in those kinds of formats, an AL only league, those kinds of leagues where you're really just sometimes scraping to find somebody that's got any sort of role, Ohtani could actually be fairly valuable. But otherwise, I think anything that's shallower than that, certainly any sort of mixed league, unless it's a daily lineup league, I don't think you're going to be looking at Ohtani. But he's going to be really interesting for those daily leagues.
And now I'll waste everyone's time for 30 seconds, and I'll ask you this hypothetical question, tying everything we've talked about together. If Ohtani had one start in his one start week, and it was at Yankee Stadium against Giancarlo Stanton and all those home run hitters, and you were in an AL-only league, would you consider using him for his three DH appearances and just sitting out that start? Those are the kind of scenarios I could see maybe being, because we know he's a one-start pitcher every week. If it was like an at Yankee Stadium or an at Houston, if they're really rolling again next year, maybe in a deep league you would consider him as a hitter?
I think so. I mean, again, it really, we have to see how it translates, and I'm much more concerned about for him as a hitter. Like I said, I've got a fair amount of confidence that he's going to be fine as a pitcher, but he did strike out a lot for Nippon Ham Fighters. So he's clearly got the power, got on base at a good clip, but the strikeouts do worry me. So it's going to be more of a wait and see. But, if you're going to ask me right now to make the decision, yeah, I'm probably sitting him.
Yeah, it's interesting. So now I'm going to jump off those two big moves to another move that, so if I was to say that neither Stanton nor Ohtani will be the biggest fantasy asset we're going to talk about on the podcast today, as far as transaction goes, and it could be next season, D. Gordon, I think I can make a case for that, because Gordon last season in some fantasy, valuation metrics was every bit as valuable as Stanton. He gets traded from the Marlins to the Mariners. Does this trade to you make him more or less appealing? I think D. Gordon, like how we're going to draft him is like a whole separate topic. And it's almost like the Gary Sanchez where, yes, we know Gordon's really valuable, but philosophically, do you want to draft someone in the first three rounds of your draft who hits no home run, drives in almost no runs all season? That's its other, I think, topic, and more about building your squad. But from a purely just assessing Gordon on his own, do you like him better with the Mariners than you did with the Marlins? Or would you have rather just seen him stay with a club where he was really valuable last year?
I think it's pretty much of a wash I think that, you know, the Marlins, again, they were sort of middle of the road offensively last year. I don't expect that the Mariners are going to be, you know, one of the juggernauts of major league offenses this year. And then in terms of the managers, I mean, that's with D. Gordon, that's the thing I'm most interested in. And, you know, I think maybe the Mariners and Scott Servais, I think maybe there's a little bit more of an aggressive approach there. But, you know, I look at last year, they acquired Gene Segura and Gerard Dyson. And they were used slightly less often for base stealing at a little bit lower rate than they were respectively Segura with the Diamondbacks, Dyson with the Royals. And they were coming from teams that had managers that were sort of notoriously aggressive in terms of base running. So I think that Scott Servais' approach is a little bit below that, you know, that Ned Yost level. And so I think it's sort of a lateral move in that regard for D. Gordon.
Yeah, in my eyes, it maybe raised the floor a little bit just because I think the Mariners will have a pretty good lineup next year, and we don't know, as we discussed, where the Marlins are heading with their lineup. But because those steals are, like you said, so impacted by the manager's decision, I've always had the theory that you don't trade for D. Gordon unless you're going to use him and let him do his thing, because that's, you know, he's basically the best. Him or Billy Hamilton are probably the best base stealers, or the most frequent base stealers, at least in baseball right now, or Trey Turner. If you're going to trade for him, you know what you're getting. There's no point in getting him if you're not going to let him do his thing. That being said, we also know in fantasy that there could be a big difference in value from Gordon getting 60 steals next year to getting 47, right? Like, I think that's probably the difference as to whether you'd invest an early round pick in Gordon or wait a couple more rounds, isn't it?
Absolutely it is. And you know, even if Gordon replicates the 60 steals, you sort of raised this point just a moment ago that you're putting your eggs in the basket of, you know, really certainly the stolen base category, and then to a lesser degree with run scoring and batting average. I think he'll score his runs, but the batting average I'm not so sure about. And then, you know, if he misses any time, if he has, you know, an off year, you're losing a lot of value there. So I just think that he's a risky pick in that regard because of sort of the lopsidedness of his value. So, the fact that, you know, if you were down a dozen steals, that could be a very big deal.
Yeah, and it's just something I think, like I said, I think the numbers get so big with base stealers like Gordon that people don't notice them as much. If you went from being a 20-steal player down to like a 7-steal player, everybody notices and they say, wow, you were, you know, a 5-category player and now you're not. And with Gordon, you know, like he could have the same 13 steal drop. It matters just as much, but I think people don't give it enough credit. And now I want to move on to maybe some of the lesser moves of the week, but still ones that can impact fantasy leagues. And Tyler Chatwood, I think, is emerging as one of the really interesting guys this offseason at the late end of drafts. I put in our notes that I kind of see two sides of Chatwood. So either you look at his career strikeout to walk ratio, which I believe is 1.6, which is really bad, and kind of suggests that it won't matter where he's pitching. He can't really be successful until he cleans that up. Or you look at his road numbers while he was a member of the Rockies, where he could consistently post a really healthy, like, you know, mid to low 3 ZRA on the road. And you say, okay, maybe there's something here now that he's out of Colorado. And in one of those scenarios, you'd like him in the late rounds, and in the other one, you wouldn't want to touch him. So where are you sitting right now, Al, with Tyler Chatwood?
Yeah, I'm closer to siding with the argument that the strikeout-to-walk ratio is something you can't really live with. And again, to go back really to the other side of it, well, on the road, he's maybe a mid-threes ERA guy. Well, if you couple that with the strikeout per inning and a whip that's, you know, decent, let's say 1.20, that's, you know, that's something to be interested in. But when you're coupling it with a high whip and, you know, far less than the strikeout per inning, that ERA doesn't really look nearly as impressive. And I think that's we can't assume a whole lot more for Chatwood. In fact, I wrote a piece about him for my own blog, almelchior.com, and I charted out his progress last year in terms of the velocity spike, which was the largest for practically any pitcher last year. And the strikeout increase, I mean, it was there, but it wasn't as high as you might have thought that it would be. And I think that his issues with control and not throwing in the strike zone very often, I think that really limits his ceiling as a strikeout pitcher, regardless of how hard he throws or with how much spin he throws. So maybe with the Cubs, you know, he can improve his control, and I think that would literally be a game changer for Chatwood. But I'm just certainly not going to assume that on draft day. So I'm not going to invest anything of real value. I mean, if I'm in the final round and he's still out there and I'm not enthralled with the other options in my queue, I'd take a flyer. But in a 12-team mixed league, that's as far as I would go with Chatwood.
Yeah, and his, you mentioned the strikeout rate. Like last year it was 7.3 per nine innings, career 6.1. If that doesn't really change, it also really limits his ceiling. So, I mean, he's not someone with the potential to be a number one or number two type mixed league starter where you're drafting someone late, like we've talked about someone who drafted, say, Luis Severino late last year, just taking a flyer. They're someone who had a pedigree and a lot of upside. With Chatwood, I think your upside is that he gives you a low ERA, a respectable whip, and wins some games. So I don't mind him late. I actually like him more late in the shallow league than as my fifth starter in a 15-team league or my fourth starter in an NL only. I don't know if that makes sense to you, but I wouldn't want to be in a situation where I depended on him, but I wouldn't mind owning him for the first three starts of the season in a shallower league just to see what he looks like.
No, that totally makes sense. Yeah, because that's the beauty of the late round flyer. They're not too far in value from the folks that don't get drafted. So I totally get that.
Mm-hmm. And then a couple bullpen moves that are not finalized but pending and look like they're going to be finalized. One is Brandon Morrow to the Cubs, and one is Luke Gregerson to the Cardinals. Now, the offseason is really just getting going, even though it's been going for a good month now. But as far as transaction goes, it seems to be just getting going. And both these teams are likely to add more relievers. But if you had to kind of look ahead, do you think either Morrow or Gregerson could go into spring training as the leading candidate to close on their respective team?
I think they could, and you're absolutely right. I mean, it's early on, so this is absolutely dependent on the other moves that could be made. But either one certainly profiles as somebody who could close. And, of course, Gregerson has had some closing experience with the Astros. So, you know, even regardless of who these teams sign going forward in the coming weeks, I could see Morrow and Gregerson in that discussion all season long because there's so much closer turnover as it is that if somebody superseded them going into opening day, they'd both be relievers that you'd have to keep an eye on as a potential replacement. And that's really the worst-case scenario.
Yeah, absolutely. And before I tip my hand on some of my thoughts on them, I wanted to ask you one more follow-up question on them. And that's, if they do get the chance to close, let's say both got the chance to close, is there one that you believe in a little bit more than the other? I mean, Morrow was better last year, but the injury history, Gregerson was fine prior to last season. Is there one you'd have a little more faith in than the other?
I would say Morrow, but not only is there the injury history with Morrow, but what he did last year was sort of out of the blue. So he doesn't have a whole lot of experience as a reliever. So you can look at it as one of two ways as well. Okay, he's been given this chance to relieve, and this is who he is. Or maybe this is as good as it gets for Morrow. So I have some real concerns and doubts about Morrow. But at least, you know, if he can stay healthy, I mean, we can see what he can do. Gregerson seems to be maybe in the early stages of decline. His average fly ball distance allowed has gone up in each of the last two seasons. It really hurt him last year, giving up a lot of home runs. So I do worry about that with Gregerson. I think maybe he has seen better days. So while I think both are very risky, I would rather invest in Morrow.
Yeah, I would as well. And for the following reasons, this morning I really read in really close detail, kind of looking to read the tea leaves or looking between the lines on some things in the Morrow article on our site and the Gregerson article on our site. And I got the impression that maybe the Cardinals' plan, we'll see, but I got the impression that maybe the Cardinals' plan is to get a few relievers in the offseason and then go from there because they've lost a few to free agency that they had last year. And obviously Trevor Rosenthal is a free agent, but also is injured. With Morrow, the money is greater than the money I believe that Gregerson is expected to get. And I do think that does say something. When I saw his money, I initially thought, oh, I wonder if they're going to try him back as a starter, but that's not the case. at about 10, if it ends up being around $10 million a year, the Cubs are a smart organization. They know they can get, you know, seventh inning guys for less than that. So the fact that they offered him more money makes me feel like they really wanted him and that maybe they are more comfortable giving him a higher leverage role. So I wondered if just the money difference might, even seeing what Yusmeiro Petit got from the A's last week, you know, Morrow kind of jumped all of those pitchers on the strength of a really good season last year, but it's hard to expect. You're not going to get 80 innings, I doubt, out of Morrow. So I don't think that's the plan. So I wonder if they are expecting them to be really high leverage innings. Do you think that's a possibility that the money maybe could be a sign of where they're thinking with him?
I usually take it that way. So yeah, I think that is another factor in my level of confidence in Morrow as opposed to Gregerson. I think if they put that money out, I mean, it seems far more often than not, that means that they're literally invested in giving that player a high profile role or a high leverage role. So I think that absolutely makes sense.
Yeah. And then the last player to talk about and just quickly is Chris Iannetta going to the Rockies, way under the radar compared to most of these other transactions. That being said, for those in two catcher leagues, Rockies catchers are usually a factor. So and sometimes in a one catcher league, depending on how they choose to divide up the role. So do you have an idea of how often you think Iannetta will play? Will he be used as the number one catcher? Is it a 50-50 split do you think we're headed towards? And then I guess that would kind of answer my second question of what kind of league you would want to use him in.
Well, yeah, and here's where the contract comes into play again, because he's going to get $8.75 million over 2 years. That seems pretty affordable. And my first thought really upon seeing that was, well, are they going to try to get another catcher? Because that seems pretty economical for your starting catcher. And I mean, he hasn't really played a lot over the last several years, sort of hovering around 300 plate appearances. So that's actually what I've got him projected for right now, is 300 plate appearances. And with fairly similar numbers to what he put up with the Diamondbacks last year, because I'm not really entirely buying that performance. So the move to Coors Field, and Chase Field's a nice venue too, but the move to Coors Field is something of an upgrade. But if he weren't going to Coors Field, I'd be downgrading him, substantially this year, because in terms of hard contact rate, average fly ball distance, those things just don't add up to the isolated power that he put up last year. So I think that's all going to sort of cancel out, and he's going to put up similar numbers to last year with only maybe slightly more playing time.
Yeah, I think 300 plate appearances for this early in the offseason, I think, is pretty good projection. And, yeah, maybe 15 home runs, 40-ish RBIs, and a batting average. I agree with you. I think he's a bit of a regression candidate. But maybe Coors Field helps the batting average, and he can hit at least 250 again, which would be nice. At that point, he's a pretty solid option in two catcher leagues. As far as one catcher goes, I think that's not quite good enough. Maybe he's someone who you want to pick up off waivers when the Rockies are in a homestand. You think that might be?
Yeah.
For as far as I know, a lot of listeners are in one catcher leagues. I think maybe he's a homestand type guy, and you're comfortable even dropping him when they hit the road for 9 or 10 games.
Yeah. By the way, I stand corrected, because I'm looking at my projection right now. I've got him at 344 plate appearances.
Okay.
So a little bit more than 300. But this past year he ranked 20th in roto value, and like I said, with probably pretty similar numbers to what he had last year, that he's just not going to get anywhere near the top 12 for a one catcher league.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, I think that's our last topic to discuss for this afternoon. So I'll close this out in Matthew style. And thanks, Al, for stepping in for this emergency edition of the Fantasy 411 podcast. And thanks, everybody, for listening.